Okay. So here we are for the second episode of A Book I Love. Today we're in the old town of Zurich, in a square we don't know the name of, somewhere near Neumarkt and Lohengasse. It's a really beautiful square, lots of trees and a fountain in the middle. It was picked by Tine Milz, who has joined us today and who has picked the book that we're going to talk about today, which is Real Estate by Deborah Levy. I'm Geraldine Tedder, and I'm joined by Helen Thomas and Emily Apercé. And so the book today, Deborah Levy is a British South African author. She was born in 1959, and this book is part of a trilogy. It's the third part of a kind of semi-autobiographical, or I guess we can get into those terms a little bit after, series. The first one was called Things I Don't Want to Know, which was written in 2013. The second one was called The Cost of Living, written in 2018, and now Real Estate is from 2021. And the whole series, but this one in particular, is kind of about the search for, or the desire for, home in lots of different aspects. There's a kind of desire for real estate, as in financial terms. Then there's a kind of desire for home beyond property, or what that means beyond financial terms. And I think these two things also always interplay throughout the book, kind of the more, let's say, fantasy aspect of what it means to feel at home, or where home could be, what your fantasy home might look like, and the kind of real aspect of what it means to live, and your living conditions of having a home and keeping a home. Just to start off, why did you pick this book, Tine?
Why did I pick this book? That's a good question, because I remembered when I bought this book, and it was a very special day. It was on the 20th of September 2021, so almost a year ago, in Ghent, when I was visiting an opera piece. And then I went into like a bookshop, and I saw this book, and it was somehow talking to me, and I don't know why. It's like this very particular cover. It's like red and a woman's shoe, and I called Real Estate. And also the title did not really talk to me, but somehow it was telling me I have to buy it. And then I read it on the train from Zurich to Venice. And it really caught me, because I felt very connected to the person who spoke to me, which is maybe the author, because it is, of course, a living autobiography.
That's what she calls it as well, isn't it?
Yeah. And it really felt like living with someone, and traveling with someone, and traveling especially with someone in her thoughts, because the book is a very personal book, I think, which does not want or pretends. It's like flowing with the thoughts of a woman who has a lot of desires and who is in a very special time in her life. Like, she's shortly about turning 60, and she reflects on how to live as a woman, how to work as a woman, but also reflects on a lot of philosophical and literature terms of things that she encountered in her life. And that's something that really struck me, because I often take a lot of notes, and I often wonder how can I sometimes connect all those thoughts of like picking up quotes, or knowing that was one of my favorite books or a favorite song. And she really like traveled with me, or let me travel with her in her thoughts, And sometimes she starts with a song and then ends up with a breakup or with like buying shoes and then like thinking about the apartment she wants to live. So I really was very amazed by this very intimate way of touching me. And it's not particularly like intellectual, the book, and it's not particularly brilliant, but it somehow has a very special bond with the woman who wrote it. And I started with this book, and then I read the first one, and then the second one, and then I started to read her novels. So it was a travel backwards somehow. And yeah, and I thought it's a very nice book to give, especially to women. And I gave it to my mom and to also older friends, and they all had like a very special encounter with the book. So that's why I chose it.
I'm not sure I agree that it's not intellectual, because for me it's a really theatrical book, and I was wondering whether that was somehow what was appealing to you, that she it seems like it's very natural and she's telling you about her life, but actually I think it's incredibly artificial in a way. And and the way I noticed it was when, you know, I was reading it and I was thinking, this really reminds me of this Leonora Carrington book that I love. And I was thinking, oh. And then, you know, 5 pages later, she talks about the book, Leonora Carrington. I was thinking, oh, that's really interesting. And it reminded me of when I was a small child and you'd read a book and you'd really like the characters, or you'd identify them, and then you'd start to try and talk like them, and you know, like you think they acted. And I really felt that, you know, I really felt that that's what she was doing. That's why, to me, that's what made me realise it was quite theatrical, that you felt she was in a way acting out these women from the books, and that was very literary actually. So she somehow encapsulated the rooms of the books. I don't know, described in the way that those women writers would describe them. And so, yeah, I thought that was, for me, that was my favourite part of it, that the way she did that. There's a real artificialness, which is problematic, but also really intriguing, I think.
Yeah, but that's very funny what you said, because I always felt like she's trying out different versions of herself. Mm-hmm. Like, also, like, who am I? Because the question she's also having in this book is like, how can I write like a female role for a movie? Mm-hmm. So, and it feels like she's like also like staging her own movie. Mm. Like she's looking back and figuring out like different versions of the character she might want to write about, because the character she wants to write about is of course herself. Mm-hmm. So, and she's like having this very weird and also problematic kind of like dialogue with herself about what is a woman and what is not a woman. How can I stage a woman in her 60s? And it's also sometimes like a big cliche, like of how she does it, but in a way that she's somehow very honest to herself. Like she stages herself in this kind of retrospective movie. She wants to maybe see herself somehow, right? Yeah.
But somehow I also found, I mean, I really like also the book. There's some really familiarity in the way she writes, and with those kind of envolée lyrics sometimes, where she makes a lot of associations of ideas. She sees something and then she passes from one thing to another. And I find that really liberating in a way that you see that she gives a lot of importance to imagination and to sometimes ways of thinking you think you might be crazy, but actually it's also great, and it's also a good thing to cultivate your own imagination and the fantasy of it and how it's connected to reality. But I also like in the format of the text the fact that you're in her head, and then she has the citations which are coming as poems within the decor she's setting. It opens up ideas and it's more reflective, like it's like small inputs and brings you to somewhere else almost, like things she can't maybe transcribe with really precisely, but it comes in dialogue really well, I found. But something I was always thinking, there is something really irritating and about this exaggeration of some things, because she's really, really funny. It's really joyful to read in the way she depicts some of the personage around her life. she's really ironical, but because it's kind of a travel book also, not book, and she travels, she's like a vagabond somehow. And I don't know, when she's in Paris, for instance, the way she starts to describe every, like, it's a lot about the everyday details, and she starts to describe her groceries, what she's buying, the cheese, and there's something that starts to be almost annoying about that. And also, it's really like the Paris of the carte postale, so kind of really cliche. And she's not so ironical when she speaks about that than when she speaks about other characters. So there was, so for me, something which was not so challenging in terms of space. Also, like her dreams of the house, it's really bourgeois-like, and there is nothing wrong about that. But the fact that she's not as ironical as the rest, like when she depicts the house, her dream house in the Mediterranean, where she starts to, I don't know, she buys on the flea market casserole in cuivre, and I read it also in French. It's also another thing, but it could be like a decoration magazine house she's depicting. So for me, this was not so challenging. Maybe what was more challenging, it was the value she puts to imagination, and how, especially as an architect, this is how this is so part of what is, like, everything is substance for your work somehow. But I mean,
yeah, I think that's really interesting, because I also had a similar reaction. I also found a couple of things a bit annoying, but more actually this kind of constant referencing. But I think this discrepancy between kind of the referencing and how she imagines she could be, or kind of almost embellishing her own writing with the writing of others, and then her actual kind of descriptions of where she is, or like describing the now. And these changes are really smooth and quick. I mean, sometimes at some point I was conscious of, or I tried to be conscious of these transitions from like reference to her situation, or the narrator's situation now. And I always missed it, because it was always, the transition's always so smooth. But somehow this kind of, it being a little bit annoying, I also thought was quite opened up a kind of vulnerability that I found quite fascinating. Like, okay, you kind of know what she's laying out her desire, and like kind of saying, okay, this is what I imagine, or this is what I fantasize about, or this is what I kind of would like. And it's very staged, and it's very a little bit artificial, and you kind of, which is what happens, right, when you're kind of trying to be something you're not quite, or you don't know yet what you are yet. And this insecurity can then be a bit like cringy, kind of a bit like, yeah.
Well, I don't know, I find this issue of discomfort or annoyance really, really interesting, because, I mean, when you were both talking, I was thinking, well, is it a deliberate strategy? Because she's, I mean, I think there are many layers in the book, in what she's communicating. And one of them is a bit like, you know, when you read writers talking about their lives, it's always about travelling and, you know, going to book launches. And she's kind of, I mean, I think part of it, she's kind of like presenting these realities that we are part of, like we're a bourgeois readership. And then she's confronting us with them, and then we feel uncomfortable and we think, oh, but that's me. And it's like a very clever way of like holding up a little mirror in a way, and challenging you. So I think when you were speaking, I was thinking, because I also felt the same, I'm sure we all did, and you think, oh yeah, and that might be it, like I'm feeling a little bit embarrassed about myself. But also, I mean, I think the stage set thing, I mean, it's interesting you were looking for the transitions, because I think that, you know, all of these places she goes to as a writer, observing it in these different ways, they are, that it's almost like she's describing what the stage set should be like, or the place, you know, in describing the place with the details and the lists. But then it's like the reality outside those places doesn't exist. They're almost really like theatrical spaces in a theatre that are imaginary. And then when you were speaking, Emily, I was thinking, you know, is this the perfect brief? Is she writing the perfect architectural brief by making this description of something that, you know, kind of the boundaries of what it is change over time, don't they? Like, she changes her mind about things when she encounters something that she'd quite like to bring into her imaginary space. So, yeah, I think it's really an intriguing book.
Yeah, because maybe that's also for me why she's calling it a living biography, no? It's like, it's a bit like playing with who is this person and what kind of also like a picture we have about like, okay, she's a writer and like traveling a lot. And it was also interesting to read it from like starting with the last book and then doing the other two books, because also the other books are always, she's kind of restless also in the other books. So she's never, she can never really stay at one place, like also like coming from then. So the first book is about her growing up in South Africa with her dad who was in prison, and her mom then going to London alone. And then the second book is like her whole breakup with her husband, and then she's like doing it in Ibiza and like telling the whole breakup. And she's always traveling in time, and the like somehow the places are for her only, like as you said, a start of her thoughts, but they could be also anywhere. It's just like the surrounding doesn't matter, also like the political circumstance, social circumstance that don't matter for her, because she's like more like having an inner like dialogue with herself, or like kind of this living thoughts. And of course some of them are like really like a cliche where I'm also like, yeah, come on, this is like a really like bourgeois cliche of a writer and a female writer, like now like also like talking about Simone de Beauvoir, but somehow it's also like very pure. She's like so vulnerable and showing it without, it's like, it's fine, you know, that somehow, of course, playing with it, and of course you will be annoyed because maybe I trigger also something in you as a reader, because maybe you have the same desire and you would not write about it because it would be maybe embarrassing, because normally we would then cover it better or put a better makeup on it and that it sounds more. That's why I said it's not so intellectual. It's quite like, it's not intellectual that I think like, wow, okay, she's like the biggest thinker on the planet, and it's more like, you're quite pure in what you do, and it's kind of somehow embarrassing and cheesy, but it's somehow also fine, because that's why I somehow like you, because you're playing with me, and I think you're also lying with me, but somehow I go along with you in a very weird living way. It's like somehow I'm living with her in this, like in her head, and she's this very weird roommate we're all a bit embarrassed of, but we're all kind of like, you're right, maybe you're more honest to yourself that you write about it than I would. I would never do it the way you do. I don't know.
I would think it feels almost that there is a lack of taking position on the world, the fact that it's out of the political, social context, and she's this vagabond, and it feels, yeah.
I mean, does she not take it? I was just thinking if she doesn't take it, because it is a very, I mean, there are several parts in the book where she also like this, she goes to like a book launch and then she talks about a male author who takes up loads of space, and that actually he kind of asks her sneeringly what she's doing. I can't remember exactly what the scene is, but it's very much about her territory as a female, or how she can take up space as a female writer, like also this question of space somehow, not only her own personal space, but where does this space fit into very much like a kind of, let's say, male literary canon or something. Yeah, I don't know if you want to.
But that's an experience that, I mean, that I think for all women in any professional field, we can all identify with that, can't we? The trying to make space for ourselves issue. I guess there are moments that are more universal like that, well, universal for women to identify with, which that's a really interesting, I'd forgotten and you reminded me, and I think yes. But I mean, I was just thinking, I mean, you mentioned about going backwards. I think that's really an interesting idea, and about her coming from South Africa, which, you know in itself is an inescapably political childhood and move. And I'm wondering, you know, do you think there's any residue of that left in the book, by the time she gets to this third volume of her autobiography? Does it connect back to anything in the earlier volume?
Yeah, there are a lot of things that are coming back. Like, for example, her mother, who who's dying in the second book and who's also in the first book, of course, which is like very beautiful how she describes how her mother is somehow dying and what's her last connection with her mother. And in this book, like one, of course, it's a, like a cheesy like passage, but where, when she talks about her dad, that she never somehow misses her or missed her dad until he went back to South Africa, and now being like in his 90s, and their only real dialogue is that she sends him these pictures of melons, and he can and he can see on the picture which melon she should buy. And that's something that comes back, because these are this very special, very touching moments I like in this book, where she really then kind of opens up in a very nice way. And these are the parts that always come back, also in the first and the second and the third book. So these are the connecting things where she really is personal, and she also writes a lot about her dad in the first book, and she was not able to speak up, and she was not able to have a loud voice, and she did not speak for a long time in her childhood. So this is also interesting, for example, when you then read and see that she now then became a writer and she can speak up in a way. Of course, it's also how you frame a story, right? But it has a lot to do with her dad being in prison and not being allowed to say a lot of things in South Africa, because her parents were, of course, fighting against apartheid. So then her now being a writer, like writing and being able to use language, and so
No, that's so interesting. I mean, that really is that really explains one of the strategies of the book, I think, you know, that the political is made very, very personal, and as you say, like the everyday, so you really have to actually know that it's there in order to be able to identify it. So yeah, I'd never ever have guessed that, but you know, you think, well, there must be something quite deeply political in this, because how can you come from South Africa and not, you know, and she's white, and not have something, you know, embedded within you that you can't escape? So that's really helpful. Thank you.
Yeah, also, I think this notion of home now is also for her always, like, or like, what is a real estate or what is a home? Because, like, having to move the home she had to go to London, where they always did not feel at home or somehow, and then her dad going back. So I think she's like somehow looking for this very private, maybe very bourgeois place where she can just be. Also, it's important for her to be with her daughters, to give them somehow this nest that she maybe somehow had, but somehow also missed all her life. So I think that's why it's kind of important then to also read the other two books, because there are a lot of like hints and traces, and also the involving of the writing and how he also how she then kind of became the writer who she is with the strategies she's using. So the way how she's also growing up, and so I think it's good to also read the other two books, maybe.
I mean, she also, I think this idea of the kind of bourgeois home, she also does kind of reflect on that. Like, there's also this heiress that I think she meets who has, you know, has the real estate. She has endless amount of real estate. And her conclusion is kind of, well, does she have, where is the home? I mean, it's very... This is kind of very simply put, but she kind of asks herself, you know, is real estate, does that equal what I imagine it to be? And kind of maybe a little spoiler, or maybe I would also be interested if you read this the same way, but kind of at the end, she kind of says like her ideal, or where she feels at home, is in her writing. No, that's the kind of, all these questions are kind of just open, like, okay, what is the real estate actually, you know, what could that be, what can I aspire to, or that doesn't, those questions aren't answered. And then in the end, this is the kind of conclusion of like the whole, all these,
following this idea that you follow a desire that in she speaks about a house or like a desired house, but it could be an idea or it could be just about desiring it really precisely. And but I had the question how, I don't know, for Tini, for instance, or like Helen and Geraldine, you're more into the architecture field, Tini in the theater field, if you can say, how you make a connection to your practice in your field.
Yeah, and I think one aspect why it might be so theoretical is that she is a playwright. And I think that were her first jobs, she was writing for the Shakespeare Company in London. So she comes from theater and she writes a lot of scripts. So I think maybe that, and I did not know this before reading it. I found then out after I did the research, which is interesting because she, how you also said, Helen, she's like really like staging everything. And she's like really like, who are the main characters and who, what do I need to do a very good dramaturgy? Because she's very good in like, exactly like blurring this line of like, aha, what is now the transform, like the transformation, you don't get it. It's so well made in some way that I think that's the connection I admire when it's so smoothly that you then trapped and you're like, aha, how did that go? Mm-hmm. Something is very weird in the way how she does it. And also the book she's writing in Paris is The Man Who Saw Everything, which is a super political book. Of a man who is somehow like traveling back in time in a very weird way to go back to Eastern Germany. And it's so very blurrily written that you sometimes don't know what is the truth and what is not, and what, where are you now in like the 80s? Are you now in like London? What's going on? So she's like really a very special writer of like trapping you on a lot of ways that you have to find out how you actually ended up in that trap.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, I don't remember her using so much dialogue, and you think, well, a playwright would use a lot of dialogue, but I mean, maybe she's using the voices of the other writers as dialogue, but not actually explicitly making dialogue. I don't know. Yeah, I mean, you start to think, oh, I have to read it again now to see what these mechanisms are. But I don't know, Geraldine, it didn't seem to work, even however much you concentrate. But you wonder whether she's invented some way of creating a dialogue situation without actually using two human characters having a conversation.
But it's funny, sometimes the dialogues she has is always, and not always, are with her friends. There she often has like this dialogues with this friend she's visiting in Berlin, or her best friend who has no name, who's male, and she does not name him. That's maybe the only person who has no name in the book. Also, her ex-husband also does not have a name. Because this lover has a name. So it's very interesting who gets a name, who has no name. And she has this very weird dialogues then with friends about... also somehow this gossiping... with her friend in Berlin, she's then gossiping about this Helena she met who slept with her best friend. Like, and it's a very interesting way that I had to think about Silvia Federici when she writes about gossiping and what's the power of gossip. Mm-hmm. And her like dialogues she puts in is more like this gossiping, sharing secrets, like bonding with other women somehow in a...
It doesn't relate to gossip, but I'm just thinking about this issue of what you said about who has dialogue in the book, and then how she makes a narrative, because the gossiping makes one kind of petty narrative in a way of like who's sleeping with who and you know who's a nice person, who isn't a nice person in her eyes, and she has some ambiguity in that, which is interesting, especially with her best friend. But then there's this sequential a necklace of places which are the scenes, you know. I mean, like, I don't know, there was a beach scene, isn't there, somewhere, you know, that was the most theatrical to me, because that was really the one that you imagine like somehow seeping off like the Truman Show into into a dome or something. I mean it's just that she had, this is what is quite fascinating about the book, that there are different things going on at different levels with using different mechanisms in order to make these layers of narrative. So, I mean, writing an autobiography means you don't really have to have a narrative. There's no narrative arc. It's just a sequence of things, isn't it?
Yeah, I was wondering how much she leaves to work, or she works to live, how much, you know, she travels to have substance to write. That makes me think of my own work, or as an architect, everything can be inspirational for a project or for something, and this mix between your imagination, this fantasy world you are making in your head all the time, all the stories that go through your head and the reality. This I found fascinating. Everything is work somehow. And
yeah, because I think the one aspect we did not talk about is like this, like, it's of course a first-person narration, but who's this I, you know? It's like, of course, it's a strategy. It's like close to her, but it can also not be her. She calls it living autobiography. Yeah. So it's like all like, it's never herself. It's always like, she's always a writer and she's always staging a person she thinks she is, yeah, or might think she could be. So I think that's also very interesting, because the strategy when you have a first person narrator is like, of course you're very close because it's the I who tells you, but who's this person who tells you? Yeah. So it makes, of course, very fast a connection to the reader, because yeah, you trust an I more than a third person narrator somehow. Mm-hmm. So that's also an interesting strategy, because you're also like, okay, I trust you and I believe you, which is, come on, like, it's all built up in her head of the way of how do I put the sentence. And of course I put this quote now here because, but come on, like, it's also interesting. And that's also maybe the question of what is work and what is not work, because this whole writing about herself is work and not work. So it's a very interesting strategy, this like writing her own biography. And it's totally different than, for example, Annie Ernaux, who like wrote completely different about her own life, in the way that she had like a different strategy, and it's more like a way of analyzing also the society through her eyes. And that's not what she does. She gives you more like a personal interview, but maybe it's not her. Maybe it's all made up. Yeah. Maybe some things are true and some things are not true. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. I mean, I found a section, but I don't think I should read it. but it's a section that has all these people in it. I don't know if you want to read it, Tina, because it's your. It's here. It's in London. But she starts talking. All these different characters come up. There's no dialogue.
This is my Norwegian. Yeah. My Norwegian friend Agnes came over for a spritz cocktail. She wore sparkling green earrings that were almost as blinding as her very white teeth. It was 6 p.m. and we both just finished work. A fierce wind was blowing through London. The weather forecast people had named it Storm Eleanor. No doubt about it. Eleanor was rattling the crystal windows of the crumbling apartment block in quite an assertive way. At one point, Agnes and I thought she might even crack the glass. I made the spritz with Prosecco, Campari, a dash of tonic, and a slice of orange. It was a summer drink, but as Camus said of himself, there was an eternal summer inside me, even when a storm was threatening to topple my building. You've even chilled the glasses, Anya said, examining the frosted crystal flutes I had bought in Vienna when I was on a book tour there. I told her I'd learned this trick from my best male friend. He always chilled the glasses in the freezer for margaritas, an attempt to make his third wife happy. Actually, Nadia preferred smoothies made from kale and celery. When I'd finally achieved my grand old house with the pomegranate tree, I would have separate freezers just for chilling glasses. Recently, I had replaced the fountains in the grounds of this house with a river at the end of the garden. My unreal estate now included a small roaring boat tied to the jetty of this river. My friends would drop by and find me sanding and varnishing the oars of my boat, feet dangling in the cool, clear water. Were the fish in the river? Definitely. what kind of fish. I had not yet got to the stage of identifying them because I had only recently replaced the fountains with the whole tidal river. And what was the name of the boat? It would be called Sister Rosetta, after the African-American singer Rosetta Tharpe, the godmother of rock and roll, gospel's first female electric guitar superstar. She had long been my role model for middle age, ever since I saw a film of her performing when she was 49 in Railway Station in Manchester. Her electric guitar slung over her high-collared coat and her glamorous stiletto heeled shoes were just up my street. Chuck Berry and Elvis and Little Richard had all learned a trick from Sister Rosetta. In the film, a friend had said of the force and beauty of her voice, she could make you cry and then she made you want to dance. I would enjoy painting her name on my boat. When I told all this to Agnes, she said, I just don't get why you want a house in the wilderness. You're a cosmopolitan sort of person. You like dressing up and going to parties. You like heeled shoes and high-collared coats like Sister Rosetta. In fact, you get your best ideas when you're in a crowd. So why have you gone rural? I mean, you're a diva. You always have been. I had not yet been told her about the silk sheets.
Agnes sipped the spritz and declared it tip-top. While Eleanor howled through the dilapidated building, I noticed that Agnes had more poise than when we'd last met. Her body had changed. She seemed taller, softer. She smiled more often. Since she'd separated from Ruth, her longtime partner, she told me she had started to feel things again. Sometimes this was good, other times bad. She glanced at the horses on my windowsill, her eyes stormy blue like the deep Scandinavian fjords near where she was born.
Apparently, Ruth told her she was always on her high horse and wanted to pull her off it. The high horse. The high horse. It was always good to see a woman on her high horse. Why had Ruth wanted to take her down? To where? How low? Why bother to pull a woman off her high horse? Storm Ruth. I think the high horse is supposed to suggest arrogance or superiority. But I believed in this case it really meant that Agnes had a sense of her own purpose in life, that she got on with the things she wanted to do in the world, which is sometimes called agency, or holding the reins of the high horse and steering it. After all, there is no point in climbing onto a high horse if you don't know how to ride it. I was fascinated with the high horse, and especially when a woman wanted to pull another woman off it. Ruth had spent a long time undermining Agnes and a short time loving her. They were 36 when they met and 47 when they parted. That was a lot of life, so obviously the horses had come out to play.
Agnes told me that since she had moved out of the house she had shared with her former partner, she had a very weird desire to wear real emerald earrings. I yearned for some rocks. She explained that she did not want emeralds to make any sort of statement about wealth. She was not wealthy. No, what she wanted in middle age were stones that had come from deep within the earth and that sparkled on her ears. She needed lustre. She would gaze into the windows of jewellers and think, no, those ones are too small, even though she could not afford emeralds the size of a pinhead lying in their little velvet coffins. We wondered if rocks cut out of the earth were somehow connected to blood and bone and the beginning of time. But then I pointed out that she did not want to wear coal on her ears, and coal was also hewn out of the earth. So anyway, she continued, pointing to her ears, these will do for the time being. She had bought herself green crystal earrings that were an imitation of the emeralds she wanted to glitter on her ears. Yes, she would have lustre as she rode on her high horse down the North Circular to repair her smashed screen at Mr. Cellphone. I reckoned it was time to tell her about the silk sheets, and when I did, she insisted on having a look at them. So actually, like, time is good, and I think it's quite nice to end on that, unless anyone else wants to say, yeah?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.